Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Fast Talk.
Street Talk.
Mike Graham.
Fighting the good fight with all his might. Providing a welcome dose of common sense for the common people.
Solid Talk.
Hot Talk.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
See it. Hear it. Think it. Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV, the one place where you hear the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. But let's get one thing straight this morning. The voting public have had enough of the metropolitan elite. They've had enough of the Westminster bubble. They've had enough of the BBC, of ITV, of Sky News trying to derail Boris Johnson and his duly elected government. They see through the campaigns to force the Prime Minister to resign. They don't care about the latest pictures that his detractors claim show he broke the rules, and they are certainly not buying the idea that the picture in question provided by Paul Brand yesterday of ITV actually proves anything. Let us instead concentrate on what is important to people out there today, and I speak for you because I know how you feel, because you tell me every single day. The cost of living crisis worries you. The surging price of energy is a concern. The illegal migrants that continue to arrive on our shores every single day, day in, day out, by the thousands, is a problem. We want lower taxes. We want fewer restrictions on our lives. It's really that simple. And I don't understand why anybody would want to talk about something that happened nearly 2 years ago to somebody who was in a place of work having a drink. You know as well as I do that back in November, I thought Boris Johnson should go. I thought he had run his course. I thought the whole thing had come to a clattering halt. However, times have changed. Remember what was happening back in November? The world is completely different now. The world is a very different place, and now it's time to move on. So if you want to talk about Partygate, I don't. If you want to ring up and tell me about Partygate, I don't want to talk to you about it. I want to talk to you about other things. Susan Hall is here. She's the leader of the Conservatives in the Greater London Assembly. She is officially the opposition to Sadiq Khan. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the Elizabeth line, which is £4 billion over budget and 3 years late. And everyone's going on like it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. Well, really? I don't think so. They've already evacuated it. So, not great start, really, on day one. 03444991000. Laura Dodsworth is here. We're going to talk about wokists and wokery and the fact that a banker now has been suspended just because he had the temerity to suggest that climate change fanatics might actually be a bit nutty. Well, I agree with him. And I'm not getting suspended. Well, not for that, anyway. 03444991000. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on the Independent Republican, Mike Graham. Let's get it started. Of course, the other thing we're going to talk a bit about is the fact that there are three serving police officers found to have been invading the pitch when Manchester City won the league the other day. And despite the fact that they've broken the law, nothing's going to happen to them. They've been asked to reflect on their behaviour. Isn't that nice? Susan, welcome back to the Independent Republic. A very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
How the devil are you?
I'm fine.
What on earth is going on in this country when three serving police officers, one of them a superintendent, takes part in what is effectively an illegal invasion of a football pitch, and they don't get prosecuted?
I know.
I mean, really?
Foolish of them. I suppose they will say they were taken up with the moment, with their teams, etc., etc. But, they should know better.
A superintendent of Dorset Police breaks the law and nobody bothers about it and nobody tells them to do anything, like even taking a fine. There's not even a fine given out.
No, I know. I mean, what can I say?
Yeah.
It's not good.
We haven't spoken, you and I, for a while, but last time we spoke, Crossrail wasn't finished. Nobody thought it would ever be finished. It's now finally been finished. It's cost £4 billion more than it was supposed to, which is a lot of money. It's just open today. They've just evacuated it at Paddington for some reason or other. Sadiq Khan's going on as if it's the greatest invention since the pyramids. Is it?
I haven't actually been there. I have been invited, but been busy doing other things.
Actually working.
I couldn't possibly say that, but I have a lot of faith in Andy Byford, who has taken this up. But right. because it came as a shock to us 3.5 years ago that it wasn't going to open when they said it was going to open.
Right.
And how it then costs so many millions and millions more
right.
and 3.5 years later is beyond me. But let's hope it works. Let's hope this is just a glitch today and we can move on.
I mean, for people who listen to this show and watch this show outside of London, it will mean literally nothing. You know, because all they know is that when today there is a vote for the RMT to strike over the course of the summer, which could completely wreck every single public transportation system in the country, because all trains might not work from Manchester to London, from Birmingham to London, from, you know, Edinburgh to Glasgow. It could all go and then nobody's going to come here.
No. The thing with the RMT, they're all on about, you know, up the workers and all of this. You hear this year on year. It's workers that are not going to be able to get into work if they do these strikes as they're threatening.
Right.
I think it's disgraceful. I don't think they should be allowed to strike because they can hold us all to ransom.
Well, also, doesn't it tell you an awful lot about the people who run these unions that they're actually going to strike over the course of this, the Platinum Jubilee weekend on the tubes, and they're going to shut specifically Green Park Station, which is the one closest to Buckingham Palace?
Yes, absolutely outrageous.
I mean, it's ideological, isn't it?
Of course it is. I mean, so many of these things are absolutely outrageous. They should not be allowed to strike. I hope we manage to do something to at least, going forward, to have a skeleton of staff there, because if nothing else, they need to stop and think about this. We need nurses to get to work. We need police officers, firefighters to get to work, etc. And a lot of them depend on public transport. We're all told we have to use public transport. And then, of course, they hold us to ransom because they want more and more wage increases.
Yeah. I mean, Mick Lynch, right, the guy that runs the RMT, I saw him being interviewed last night. These guys don't make bad money. You know, tube drivers, train drivers
That's
make pretty good money. Mick Lynch, do you know what he makes? £124,000 a year as a union rep.
Yeah, I know. Well, the facility time for the unions just on Transport for London is exorbitant. It really is.
It really is unbelievable. So, I mean, I don't have any high hopes for the RMT vote today. But what can we do, for example, as a government, in your case, as local London government, to stop these strikes from taking place? Is there anything you can do?
Well, there's nothing we can do. We've asked Khan to look into it. He said they should all get round the table, but he's about as useless as nothing, as you well know.
Right. Well, he's only just got back from California on his little journey to America. What was that all about?
Well, you tell me.
And why are we paying for that, by the way?
Well, we're putting questions as to how much it's cost and who has paid for it.
And how many people went with him. Because I was staggered to see that he was in what looked like Rockefeller Plaza, outside of the old NBC building, having a sort of effectively a rally with loads of people there. Now, I don't believe that anyone in New York City knows who the hell Sadiq Khan is. So the people who were there must have been organised to be there, right?
I assume so. Of course they don't know who he is. I mean, outside London, I doubt that many people know who he is.
No.
It's a pain in the neck for most of us.
Does he still have ambitions to be leader of the Labour Party, do you think?
Of course, absolutely.
Sir Keir Starmer to step aside if he gets done for his own beer gate scenario?
Well, that'll be interesting. You won't read that in any of the papers, will you? They're obsessed with the Prime Minister. And then there's this deathly silence when it comes to Beergate.
Yes, and Angela Rayner yesterday had the temerity to suggest that Boris Johnson should step aside. It's like, hang on a minute.
Because he's an embarrassment.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. You're the woman who said whose office said that you didn't go to an event which you were actually at.
Yes, and she must have known that was wrong when she heard them saying that she wasn't there. She must have known it was wrong.
But she didn't correct it.
No, she didn't.
Instead, she came out with all that sort of that ridiculous cock and bull story about, the Sharon Stone scenario, which turned out to be something that she had started herself.
I know. I mean, talk about embarrassing.
I mean, are we now at sort of the bottom troughing of politics? Because, I mean, Julie Hartley Brewer said to me just before we started, you know, I have a great deal of hope that we have politicians with integrity, that we have politicians with honour. And I said, well, to be honest, I can't think of the last time I looked up to people who were our MPs or our cabinet or our government ministers with anything other than just they're doing a job. I don't expect them to be moral crusaders. I certainly don't want them to tell me how to behave and how to live my life. But I don't really look up to them. I never have.
No, but equally, I don't think the public knows an awful lot of the work that, that MPs do. They certainly do more than is in
the public. Oh, no, listen, I get that. But the
of both sides, of all sides.
The trouble with the stories that have been coming out of late, though, Susan, is that the impression is given that the MPs in the Commons are having this kind of party lifestyle, having a great time, you know, occasionally doing things they shouldn't be doing, and not doing very much work. And you and I both know that's not true, but that's the impression.
Yes, and it's very damaging to politics. I mean, lots of these so-called parties or leaving dues or whatever they were organised by civil servants.
Yeah.
They weren't organised by the politicians.
Right.
But as always, the politicians are the ones that are in the front line. Mm. But there are so many very good politicians of all different parties that are out there really working very, very hard.
Mm.
And those of us that are in politics do see it. We also see ones that maybe aren't so much.
Well, let's talk about Sadiq Khan a bit more, because he's not one that seems to do an awful lot of work. And I know that from your conversations with me in the past, you were always frustrated at the fact that quite often during lockdowns and during COVID, he just didn't have Mayor's Question time at all, did he?
He just went missing.
Yeah.
Nobody knows. He just went missing. Didn't do anything. So, I mean, he'll never get accused of having any knees up, because
right.
nobody knew where he was, what he was doing.
Oh.
He just wasn't interacting with anybody.
And how is it now? Is it any better?
Well, he comes down to this new building where he's put us in the Victoria Docks. I mean, it's...
Oh, what, you're not in the Globe building anymore?
No, we're not in the proper...
Well, what's going on in there?
I don't know. Nothing. I think it's empty.
So what, they've evacuated that office in order for you to work further away from the centre of town?
Further away from central town. People don't want to go there. Constituents that used to come and see us to ask us issues, obviously you can get to London
yeah.
Bridge quite easily.
Yes.
You cannot get down to where the Crystal is easily.
Right.
And it's quite sad today coming here, looking at the old building, thinking
yeah.
it was purpose-built, and that
And what's the plan for it?
Man moved us.
Are they selling it off? What?
No, we don't own it. It's owned by other people.
Right. So what, they're just going to rent it out to somebody else?
I honestly don't know.
That's a shocking thing. I mean, for me not to know that is quite shocking, but also I had no clue that was what was going on.
Yes, it's appalling. Everybody was against it, including the Labour members, but they didn't speak up.
Right.
They certainly didn't speak up loud enough. No,
right.
I call it the arse end of the East End, which goes down like a lead balloon.
But it is, though.
I mean, it's so difficult to get there. It really is. And you only need one of your connections to go wrong. And,
yeah.
And we have to be there for 9:30, which is fine.
Right.
But when you live the other side of London, so
right.
I'm leaving home sort of 6:15.
That's ridiculous. What an absolute maniac. Well, we'll come back to that. Susan Hall is here. She's the leader of the opposition for a change, a decent leader of the opposition, unlike the one in Parliament. She's the leader of the opposition against Sadiq Khan. So there's lots of things to talk about. The RMT will be voting later on. We'll talk about that. We will also talk, of course, about the police invading a football pitch illegally and not being punished for it. 0344 499 1000 is the number. This is a Partygate-free zone, by the way. If you really want to call me up and talk to me about that, you better have a damn good reason, because otherwise it's not going to happen. 0344 499 1000. Loads of people going, oh, Mike Graham, he's not democratic. Yes, I am. This is Talk TV.
On DAB+, on the app, Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Susan Hall is here with us. She is, of course, the representative of the Tory party in the Greater London Assembly, which, unbeknownst to me, has been moved from the big building that used to be right by Tower Bridge to some place in the East End. I won't repeat what Susan called it, but I think I absolutely agree with you. Local elections-wise, though,
yep.
Because people always say to me, how is it that Sadiq Khan, who seems to be so unpopular, keeps winning and getting back in as mayor? But in Harrow, there was a little bit of at least a glint of light, wasn't there?
There was. We won the council back in Harrow,
right.
So very happy about that.
Mm.
And we got lots of new people joining us because of these wretched LTNs and cycle lanes.
Yeah. Which have totally ruined London. I mean, you literally
yes.
cannot now get from point A to point B. I mean, maybe
no.
Crossrail and Elizabeth Line, whatever you want to call it, will be a success, because it's so hard to get across town now.
Well, it is, and you only have to... I mean, I spend too long on Twitter, I accept that, but I follow a lot of black cabs.
Oh, they're beside themselves, aren't they?
They are. They really are. These wretched LTNs. And then you drive past cycle lanes, or rather you slowly chug past cycle lanes. very few used to the extent one would hope that they would be used. The amount of road space they're taking up, it just makes
nonsense. Listen, I've got perfect sympathy with cyclists who want to use a cycle lane, and I know that during rush hour they do use them. Mm. But surely it would have been a better idea to have a sort of a changeable lane, if you like, because the cycle lane mostly, when I still drive in and out. The cycle lanes are busy in the mornings, busy in the evenings, rush hour, but during the rest of the day, completely deserted. So why wouldn't you just open the road to everybody at that point?
Yeah, like a bus lane,
I suppose. Make it like a bus lane, which is a sort of temporary cycle lane at certain times of the day. That surely would be more sensible.
Yeah, I don't know why they haven't done that. There's probably a very good reason.
Yeah, well, but, I mean, they must be spending an absolute fortune. I mean, do you ever see the accounts and how much cycling business has cost London and Londoners?
No, I think I'd be mortified.
Yeah, absolutely right. Let's talk a bit about what it is that the Labour Party now stands for, because that's what I always like to ask people, either from the Labour Party or from any other party. Keir Starmer, whatever his situation is with Beergate, is still the leader of the opposition. But they don't seem to have very many ideas. The only idea they've now finally fallen upon is a windfall tax on energy companies. But obviously Boris Johnson doesn't want to do that. What's your view of the sort of situation with the cost of living crisis? What should we do, or what can we do?
Well, I think the green taxes I would look at.
Right.
Certainly, because I think they make up something like 25% of our bills.
Of our energy bills. Yeah, that seems like a no-brainer to me.
Well, or even if they reduced it, I think that would be something that would be good for everybody.
Yeah.
There's a case for looking at the VAT on certain things.
Yeah.
But we should be looking at that. I'm not particularly for a windfall tax. I know lots of people, most people are. But actually, it would bring in such a little amount. It sends a wrong message, I think, to businesses. And whilst especially people like Keir Starmer want to knock businesses all the time, it is businesses that give people jobs, and it's jobs that people out of poverty.
And my worry about a windfall tax as well is that all it does is it takes money from the people who are charging so much money for their service, when it should be really the other way around. We should be forcing them to charge less so that people spend less money, because otherwise people, it's not saving anybody any money. And giving, and I'm not comfortable with the idea of a Conservative government handing money out to the people and saying, oh, sorry, you can't afford to live in the house you're in. Here's 500 quid.
Well, the government have been trying to do everything they can to increase jobs, to get people out of poverty. And that is the way to do it. So people can earn their money and feel a sense of worth.
Mm.
And then hopefully there'd be more money left in the system to look after those that really do need looking after, people with disabilities, etc.
Yes.
Or people that have fallen on hard times through
genuinely. Because,
yes,
I mean, the
and
thing
it
is
happens,
that,
yes.
And obviously people, I think, have some sympathy for the government in the sense that they didn't see COVID coming, they didn't expect it to come.
No.
However, there was an awful lot of money wasted. You know, we gave away loads of money to people who were fraudulently claiming it. We should have been better at that. You know, we've written off, what, 5 billion quid that people claimed from companies that had literally just been set up that day. And somehow they managed to con the government into paying the money.
I think they are looking into that. But we also, as with everything to do with COVID, we need to go back in our minds to how things were.
Mm.
We were all frightened. We were all, so many of us were at home, either furloughed or still being paid.
Yeah.
And we were the lucky ones. Mm. You know, that money has got to be found from somewhere. We've got to get back to some sort of normality, but not forget the dreadful state we were all in.
Mm.
And that goes back to all these parties or whatever else, that people forget that most of us were at home where we knew we were safe, because we didn't know how bad this was.
No.
And before people had the injection, we'd had no sense of whether it would kill us off, quite frankly.
No.
And with care homes, etc., I know why they were then so very careful and didn't let people in, because they were terrified that they'd end up with it getting into the care homes.
Yeah.
And basically killing off the residents.
Well, which to a large extent ended up happening anyway.
Yeah.
But of course, we're now getting an awful lot of sort of, you know, realignment, shall we say, to be kind, and a different remembering by various people. I mean, Jeremy Hunt, for example, came out the other day and said, oh, I was never in favour of lockdowns. Oh, really? Well, why didn't you say so at the time? You know, Jacob Rees-Mogg has said, well, I wasn't in favour of a lot of the restrictions that were brought in, but we had cabinet responsibility. We couldn't say anything.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people would have preferred for those people to have stood up and said, actually, I don't think this is right.
Yeah, well, hindsight's a wonderful thing. Ask Keir Starmer. Yeah. I mean, old Captain Hindsight.
Captain Hindsight.
I mean, and we didn't know at the time. People need to go back to their own thoughts and remember how frightened we all were. We were all tuning in at 5 o'clock to see what that day's news was.
At the beginning, but certainly not towards the end of 2020, I don't think. I mean, towards the end of 2020, I think certainly here at Talk Radio, we were asking a lot more questions and saying, are you really sure that this is what we need to do? And when the second lockdown came, it was like, the first lockdown didn't really work, so and you killed off an awful lot of businesses. I mean, I don't know what your view is of how London has recovered. I mean, it seems very much busier now. Tourists are coming back. There's a lot more money in the economy here. But there's still lots of parts of London that are quite destitute, aren't there?
Yes, there are. It's definitely come back in pockets, and I assume it will continue to do that. Mm. But hopefully, now we're all far more secure in our thoughts, and we feel safer. I mean, there's hardly anybody wearing masks, etc., on the underground now, and the underground is very busy. Mm. I can certainly vouch for that.
Every time I go on it, in fact, it's absolutely rammed, no matter what time of the day or night it is.
Yeah.
But now, of course, they're trying it on with monkeypox, telling us, oh, we must be careful, this is how COVID started. And I mean, I don't think anybody in their right mind is in any way concerned about monkeypox, because it's like chickenpox. That's right. Pretty much what they say. We used to have chickenpox parties.
So that everybody
to give it to everyone.
You did it for your kids,
I mean,
so they'd
sure
all get it.
Yes. We should have a monkeypox party, but I mean, you know, I've heard worse ideas.
Yes, no, that's right. No, but it's certain media outlets, isn't it?
Yeah.
I loved your comments at the beginning of the programme. It's right. Some of these outlets are absolutely shocking.
Yeah, it's incredible. I never thought I'd say this, but I'm actually ashamed to claim that I'm in the same business as some of these people, because they are so absolutely and utterly biased.
Yes, they are.
They actually now, not only are they biased in one political direction, but they actually change facts. They actually don't report things because they don't want to.
Yeah.
They don't say things that everybody knows happens to be the case. It's extraordinary. Yeah.
But if you only get your news from one of those outlets, then that's what you assume to be the case, and that's why it's quite dangerous.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely right. Well, listen, we're pretty much out of time, so it's great to see you. Must see you again, I'm sure, at various different points. What have you got on for the rest of the day?
I'm going in for meetings at City Hall, and later this week I've got Fire Committee and then the Police Committee, where my colleagues from other parties will be asking, of course, about Partygate.
Of course they will. And you can ask us on our behalf, or for our listeners' point of view and our viewers' point of view, ask Sadiq Khan just how much money he spent on cycle lanes and see if you can get an answer.
I will put in the official question.
Very good. Thank you very much indeed. Susan Hall, opposition leader at the Greater London Assembly, which has now moved outside of London for some reason. Well, almost. This is Talk TV.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
How about this from Steve in London? If the RMT votes to strike after taxpayers protected their jobs whilst they did nothing during COVID, Grant Shapps should move forward with automation as fast as possible. If we can do it with cars on the road, how is it so difficult to do it with cars on rails? Well, I think that's absolutely right. You know, we've already got, in many parts of the country, automated machinery. For example, they've got a tram service in Edinburgh, which I think runs without drivers. I'm not entirely sure. We've certainly got the DLR, Docklands Light Railway, here in London, which runs without drivers. And you don't need drivers. It just runs on its own, automated completely by somebody in a control room. The London Tube Network does have drivers, but doesn't really need them because, again, runs on rails, could absolutely be fine without any kind of supervision whatsoever. The RMT people make a great deal of money. The man in charge, Mick Lynch, makes £124,000 a year as the union representative. Now, that, you would have to say, is not exactly socialism, is it? 0344 499 1000. We'll take your calls coming up throughout the course of the show. Let's kick things off with Joanne, who's in Birmingham. Hi, Joanne.
Hello, all right.
How are you doing? What can I do for you?
Well, I went to see the granddaughter because she's currently doing her eye level last night. And it comes to our attention that she won't be able to go to university if she hasn't had all of the vaccinations, which we were completely shocked
really?
About.
Really? Yeah, which she hasn't had any
because she hasn't had any vaccinations, so she can't go to university without being vaccinated.
Right.
And we wondered how many other parents, grandparents, family members out there were not aware of it.
Well, I certainly wasn't aware of it. When did they inform you of all this then?
4 weeks ago. This is the granddaughter. Sorry, I'm the husband.
That's all right. You carry on.
We went to visit, so say 4.5 weeks ago. We said, how are you getting on? All that good stuff. How's your A-levels going, Chip? I can't follow on because we've all been informed that unless you're fully vaccinated, you can't go. Well, she's young and fit. She doesn't need vaccination.
No, it's ridiculous. And also, there's no mandatory vaccine in this country, so that is a massive issue. Let me check that out, guys, because it's a very interesting piece of information. I'm going to go and wag a few tails and shake a few heads and see what's going on. Joanne, thank you very much indeed, and your husband. How ridiculous is that? If you're a parent, you might be able to tell me. If you're sending your kids to university, are they being told they have to be vaccinated? Because that, to me, is a massive invasion of their privacy. What's it got to do with them? Let's talk to Lisa, who's down at The Sun. Lisa Minow, travel editor, of course, because there's plenty to talk about right now, not least the opening of the new, what was called Crossrail, now called the Elizabeth Line, which has kicked off this morning. They've already evacuated it, which might bode not particularly well, but these things do happen. Lisa, very, very good morning to you. Welcome.
Morning.
And we're going to talk probably more about railways now today than we ever have, because we've got the RMT strike ballot going on, which could completely cripple the country over the course of the summer months. I'm not quite sure. We've been trying to find out from the RMT when the result of the ballot will be made available and when the ballot actually closes. But believe it or not, we haven't been able to raise anybody at the RMT today because they all appear to be working from home and nobody's answering the phone.
Yes, well, I mean, I don't know what to say about that. I do know that, you know, whatever the outcome is, and the outcome does seem to be that it would be that there is going to be some kind of strike action, it's not going to be happening until after the Jubilee weekend. But we still have that action being held independently at Euston Station, which is going to impact the Jubilee celebrations. And again, just really frustrating for people who are only just getting back to work, only just getting back on their feet. Huge cost of living crisis we've got at the moment. And this really doesn't help your average working community, your average working person who's just trying to earn a living.
Yes. Well, I was talking to some people just the other day, and I know from seeing, you know, just anecdotal information on this show that people tweet me in all the time, there's an awful lot of rail cancellations still going on. People who commute into London tell me that, you know, from places like Surrey, the fast train's cancelled. They can only take the slow train now. The fast train never runs anymore in the morning, and it never runs anymore in the afternoon. And all they get told by the rail staff is that we haven't got a shortage of drivers.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the same. I mean, I'm commuting from actually a station which is in Zone 6 right into London Bridge. And we went from sort of 6 to 8 trains an hour pre-pandemic to 2 trains an hour. Right. And it's very gradually coming back on board. But I mean, it really is a struggle for people. And this is yet another thing that they're going to have to deal with. But I think, whereas there might have been sympathy in the past, now the idea that, you know, that they are demanding these, you know, ever-increasing wages, protections for their pensions, at a time when the rest of the country really is still having to suffer the same amount and doesn't have the power to shut a rail network down.
No, exactly right. And the fact remains that it's still very, very reasonable for people to want to drive around the country. And we're always being told, oh, you must get out of your cars and use public transport. But for large portions of the country outside of the big cities, the only way to get anywhere is in a car. Right?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. You know, I think we are very lucky in London. The infrastructure in London is fantastic. And, you know, even when it doesn't work well, we've still got lots of options. The minute you go outside of the capital and outside of the sort of regional larger cities, things are really much more of a challenge. And people do need to get into their cars. And any kind of, sort of, you know, railway is really going to impact people, you know, quite significantly.
Yeah, exactly right. And as far as the other business of travel is concerned, I mean, we've got these sort of half-term holidays looming large in about a week's time. A lot of people that I know trying to go away are telling me that the flights are so expensive now that they're just taking the mickey. You know, flights that used to cost 100 quid are now 400 quid. And there doesn't seem to be any end in sight for that.
No, I mean, and I wish I could have better news for you. I mean, if you look at it anecdotally, yes, it does seem that flights are really expensive at certain times, particularly the half term. But actually, flights across the board at the moment are about the same level as 2019, if a little bit less, if you look at it across the year. And I think that is going to change. You're talking about airlines that have lost billions upon billions over the last 2 years. They have got to make that money up somehow. And as we all start to travel again, you get that supply and demand. The more people want to travel, the more they can charge for flights. And they also have the other added issue is that there aren't as many flights as there used to be pre-pandemic. No airline is yet back up to their schedules that they had before the pandemic, mainly because they haven't yet recruited enough staff. And we've seen particularly that's an issue and remains an issue with both BA and with EasyJet.
Yeah, it really is a difficult problem, isn't it? And so as far as the COVID restrictions are concerned, it looks as though by the summertime, most of those will have disappeared. Hopefully monkeypox does not come in as the next sort of great threat that stops us going anywhere. But I think we've all sort of learned from what happened before that that doesn't necessarily have to be the case, because even the government are now saying, actually, we probably didn't need to put all those travel restrictions on at that time anyway. Have we got anything to look forward to sort of for the summer holidays at least? I mean, are things going to get any cheaper? Are we going to maybe be able to get anywhere easier?
Yeah, I mean, I think we definitely are. I mean, we've had the announcement just in the last 24 hours that Spain has now dropped their vaccination requirements. So that's going to be a huge boost for families, particularly families who have children who are only just turning 12. Mm. All of a sudden, they've got to have two jabs. And that was a real struggle for a lot of families.
Yeah.
But then you're also looking at the likes of somewhere like Turkey at the moment, hugely popular for Brits. Mainly because cost of living there and actually what our pound will buy in Turkish lira is really good. That's my tip for the summer in terms of if you're looking somewhere that's really good value this summer.
Right.
I think Turkey is definitely somewhere to go. One of their beach resorts, you know, Antalya, Bodrum, places like that, Izmir, all places that I think you're going to get really good value this summer.
Right. Okay. Brilliant stuff. Lisa, thank you very much indeed. Lisa Minow, travel editor at The Sun there with a bit of hope for you. If you're hoping to go away in the summer, if you're trying to go away now, it's not going to be that easy because it's very expensive. Flights are absolutely through the roof. What used to be a sort of a quick week away with the kids to somewhere like Spain has become suddenly a massive investment in the future. But maybe by the summer it might get a little bit better. But let's talk a bit more about the RMT as well, because the Mail this morning say power blackouts, petrol shortages and empty shelves loom if rail unions vote to strike. Well, we'll see about that. This is Talk TV.
Edgy talk, plain talk, unrivaled talk. Mike Graham, the only radio show you can count on for a proper serving of good old-fashioned common sense. In search of the perfect debate.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
See it, hear it, think it. Talk radio and Talk TV.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV, the one place where you hear the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and it's unadorned. You can take the view that you don't like some of the views that I have, but you cannot argue that we bring you the real stories and we bring you the real issues. And the thing that people want to talk about this morning is the cost of living crisis, the upcoming rail strike, which is going to cripple this country if it goes ahead. The RMT are taking to the ballots today, and they're probably going to vote for a strike. We just had a member of the RMT on who couldn't tell us why they were striking, couldn't tell us whether he wanted to vote to strike, and didn't know what the terms and conditions were that he objected to, which of course has got nothing to do with the terms and conditions. Do you know that the head of the union behind the tube strike, which is coming up, a guy called Mick Lynch, has earned more than £750,000 in the last 7 years? He's currently on a salary of 124 grand, and he's complaining about the fact that tube and train drivers get a rough deal. Well, he certainly doesn't. He's doing rather well. Thank you very much indeed. Laura Dodsworth is here with us to set the world to rights, as she always does every Tuesday. We'll be talking about a great many things, including transgender in the House of Lords, or is it ladies, or is it it's? I don't know now. What do you call it? Anyway, we'll be talking about that. Plus, of course, we'll be talking about the guy who was suspended from his job as a banker because he called the climate change nutters. Nutters. Well, what's wrong with that? And also, of course, we will not be talking about Partygate because we know that you don't want to talk about it. You've had enough of Partygate. So have I. So has Laura. It's not happening. This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Let's do it right now. Laura, a very good morning to you.
Let's do it right now. Let's do it. Let's talk.
Let's do it.
Do you know, you really wrapped yourself up in knots there, didn't you, about the House of Lords? And that's the thing with this story. It is actually very hard to describe without falling over and getting very confused talking about male, female, man, woman, pronouns. In order to explain what it is you're actually talking about, I'll give you an example. I brought this quote with me so that I wouldn't get this wrong, because the Telegraph's written about it today, written about this story. And it said that this transgender lord/lady
yes.
could be the first trans peer and only female hereditary member. So this is where we get automatically into the thorny ground. You do not have female Hereditary.
No. So let's start at the beginning, then, because not everybody knows the story. So we've got a situation. First of all, let me just lay the background to the hereditary peers, because Tony Blair, of course, famously wanted to get rid of all hereditary peers, which he almost did, apart from about 99, I think. And so every so often, one hereditary peer dies and is replaced by the next in line in that particular thing. However,
they have to contest it, don't they?
There can be an election for it, which is also kind of counterintuitive, because it's the House of Lords where there are no elections.
Yeah. Well, I you know, this isn't my field of expertise, and let's not fall down that. But of course, you're in this strange situation where they have to apply to contest in the election, and the Lord Chancellor gives approval or not. So we're in a strange situation where somebody who is now known as Matilda Simon,
right,
but was formerly
Baron somebody, right?
Matthew Simon.
Right.
When the father died, became Matilda Simon, but otherwise would have become Baron Simon of Withenshaw.
Uh-huh.
So are you following me so far?
So far, so good.
Okay. So Matilda Simon has actively put herself forward. I'm going to use the female pronoun because that's what Matilda would choose to use.
Yes.
But it does make this conversation confusing.
Right.
Matilda has put herself forward actively to be in the House of Lords.
Right.
Now, putting herself forward actively means applying on the basis of having been born male, asserting her right as a natal male. Listen to this. Mm. Asserting her right as a natal male. This is what I mean. It's impossible to even talk about this story. But, of course, you can't be a baron if you are female.
No. If she was complicate it even further, if she had been the former baron's daughter, she would not presumably have been eligible
to take over. No. There are a few ladies. There have been a few exceptions. I'm afraid I can't speak of what those peculiar legal situations were allowed. I think it's more common for Scottish peers than English peers. There are a couple of little loopholes. But essentially, you do have to be the oldest boy in the family to get your seat in the House of Lords.
It's a bit like being the heir to the throne, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, I think, you know, Sam Leith wrote a fantastic article about this in The Spectator.
Right.
And if you read it, all will be clear. Clearer than we can do, you know, with our ham-fisted use of pronouns right here and now. Mm. But essentially what we have here is a lady who wants her cake and eat it.
Yes.
This is a lady who wants her pronouns and her peerage. Mm. And you cannot really have both, you know. Right. You've got to pick a horse in this race.
Yes.
Either you've changed your gender and magically become a woman with all the legal privileges and protections that confers, or you're a man that gets your seat in the House of
Lords.
And
if she was to get the seat, right, she couldn't presumably call herself Lord whatever it is, could she?
Well, no, Matilda's now a lady.
Lord Matilda.
I suppose.
Of transgender.
Would they? Would Matilda still be Matilda but be a Baron?
Baron Matilda.
You see, the reason that we have this kind of...
It's very weird, isn't it?
Yeah, the reason we have this kind of legal fiction is because of a strange loophole in the 2004 Gender Recognition Act. So the Gender Recognition Act gives people the right to transition from male to female or from female to male based on certain criteria. But there was a clause. There's an exemption. And I've brought the quote with me so that I get this absolutely right, because it's an interesting one. There's an exception for gender reassignment where it does not affect the descent of any peerage or dignity or title of honour. So basically, you can change sex except when it comes to power, peerage, and titles.
Bizarre. Because
it is
even
bizarre.
In a crown now, you can have a female as part of the line of succession, can't you?
Yeah, so this was put into place to avoid the whole thorny discussion of primogeniture.
Yes.
But I think it says more than that. I'm
trying to remember that word.
It's all right. I think what it really says is that lawmakers think it's completely okay to say you've changed your sex, except when it comes to the most privileged seats in the country and to titles and estates and power and money.
Yes.
And it's funny, isn't it? It works one way but not the other.
Mm.
So sex trumps identity when it comes to a peerage, but sex doesn't trump identity when it comes to women's prisons, women's sports, women's refuges. In those cases, identity matters more. And the use of the word dignity in that phrase is really interesting, because I feel in a lot of cases where women are worried that their female-based rights are being eroded, in the case of prisons, sports, changing rooms, their dignity isn't really considered in the same way it has been to reserve those seats in the House of Lords for blokes.
Yes. I think we should just abolish the House of Lords and then we wouldn't have the problem. What do you think?
I also don't agree with the House of Lords, but you know, we are where we are. And I don't think you can look on what's happening now as any kind of subtle form to subvert what happens. Mm. This doesn't mean that women are suddenly going to get their seats reserved from in the House of Lords, or that those eldest daughters are going to get their seats, because that would require a different change of law. What this really is about a lady who wants her cake and eat it.
How about this one for you? What if a daughter changed her sex to male?
But the clause...
She still would not be allowed, she would technically.
Not, she/he would not be allowed, because that is what the clause in the Gender Recognition Act states, that you cannot change your sex to change your acquisition of a peerage or title.
Right.
That's the only reason Matilda can get it, because Matilda is male.
But Matilda still has to run the course of an election then.
Yeah.
With only within the peers, right? So only the 98 or whatever... vote, I think, for the 99.
For me, this looks like a foregone conclusion. What do you think, Mike?
Well, I don't know.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Anyone who wanted to be a peer in that situation who didn't become one, who somehow lost out to somebody else, because there can't be really a competition, because the only people that can stand to inherit a hereditary peerage are those who are in line to do so. So it's only really a choice if there's more than one of them in the same family, presumably.
I think we know which horse is going to win this race.
And also, we're paying these people.
It is absolutely bonkers. But I have to say, as a Gender Recognition Act geek, I've been waiting for this to happen because that clause has been there since 2004. And here we go.
Yeah.
The real life example of the legal fiction made absolutely apparent
madness.
To the nation.
Madness. Let's talk about flags, because that's also something that's got you this morning, hasn't it? Got your goat.
I think it was quite magical actually to see Regent Street bedecked with Union flags.
Yes.
Yeah.
Why not?
Definitely. It looked really happy, really festive.
Yeah.
And of course, Regent Street's been festooned with Union flags in order to celebrate the Platinum Jubilee.
Quite right, too.
As you'll know, not only do I want to abolish the House of Lords, I'm something of a polite Republican, but come on.
Yeah.
You know,
this is also, it's
70 years.
It's also an homage to a woman who has been absolutely brilliant as a woman. Fantastic as a supreme kind of leader, world leader for so many decades, and just a fantastic advert for Britain.
Absolutely. Now, a certain political activist has described the scene of flags in Regent Street as fascism.
Idiot.
I don't want to name this person because I don't feel this story should be about them.
No.
It should instead be about a type of snowflakery that associates the Union flag with fascism. I think this is really unfortunate. What the Union flag actually represents is the United Kingdom.
Yes.
It's the United Kingdom, and it's not a fascist flag. And in this case, when we see those flags festooning our streets, it's to celebrate the Platinum Jubilee.
It's
to celebrate the Queen.
And you
there's
know
nothing
what's
about
ironic
this. This
is
fascist.
That if you had run all the flags up, taken all the Union flags down and put them all, replaced them all with Ukrainian flags, that would be fine.
Oh, absolutely.
That's absolutely no problem.
Well, I can make a little prediction here. I think that probably some of the people who'll be complaining the most about the Union flag will be the ones who've got Ukrainian flag avatars on social media.
Oh, yeah.
Because one form of nationalism is okay and another form of nationalist pride, not fascism, is not okay. I mean, the streets where I live, which are also festooned in Union flag bunting, at no point have I thought, gosh, I better not walk down that street. It's a ghetto of fascism. That's dangerous. What I thought was, how cheerful, how nice, how lovely to see people celebrating after a couple of years of flipping well-being in the doldrums. Yes.
And also, how nice to be proud of your country.
Yes.
You know, we don't say that it's the best country in the world. Some people do.
Why not?
But, you know, you can. The point is that even if you don't think it is the perfect place to be, it's still our country and we should be proud. I spoke to a German guy when the last World Cup was on, the one before Russia, was it? Maybe it was the Russian one. And it was Germany were knocked out and we were watching in a pub together and he happened to be sitting there and he was German, so we chatted. And he said it was only really in the World Cup that the Germans hosted in 2006 that Germany and people in Germany could actually be proud of their flag again, because they spent so long being ashamed of what had happened during the Second World War that they couldn't really get their heads into it, they couldn't discuss it, they couldn't talk about it. But we'll come back to that because we've got to stop for a minute. And he said only now, and we're talking 50 years on, could they actually face looking at their own flag. And I think we are in danger of being in that place. This is Talk TV.
Talk Radio.
Bish Bosh Berserk.
Lively debate, now with 0% drift and dither.
Always read the label.
A roadmap for the future of debate. Talk Radio.
On DAB+, on the app, Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Laura Dodsworth is here. We were just talking about the German flag and the German experience, and you know a bit about that.
I do. I mean, I felt a little bit emotional when you even mentioned it, because I'm half German. I was bullied quite badly as a child for a period of time
in this
at school. Yeah, in this country for being half German. My dad used to deny being German.
Wow.
I've been in the interesting situation of being in a lift with my dad, and he was asked his nationality. He said a very strange transatlantic accent, and he said he was Lithuanian, and wouldn't you know it, the person who asked was Lithuanian. Ooh. Started speaking Lithuanian.
Oh God, that's like your worst nightmare.
Excruciating nightmare. But I think there's a great sadness when people aren't proud of their nation. Now, personally, I'm tired of the self-flagellation and the self-hatred in this country. There is so much to be proud of. And ultimately, this self-hatred, it's bitter. You know, these people aren't being snowflakes. They're being nasty. And carrying around this kind of bitterness, this bile, is ultimately not just hurting them, because they're the ones who are experiencing it and carrying it around.
Right.
But all of us, it rubs off on us.
Yes.
I do not feel our flag is fascist.
No.
I love seeing the celebration. And it just looks nasty and petty, and it's taking away from the joy of the events.
But also, these are all the same
we
people.
We all need to reclaim the flag.
Yeah,
everybody needs
totally.
To say, it's not fascist. I'm not giving into that. I'm not going to be ashamed. My mum has the Union flag in her front garden.
Right.
And she has St. George's Cross in her
wow.
back garden. And I think it's
good
really sweet. She's fiercely patriotic.
But these are
patriotic.
The same people who love the idea of waving EU flags. I mean, I remember back to the days of the Brexit negotiations and the stalemate in the House of Commons when we were down on College Green practically every day for months on end. And there was huge swathes of EU flags flying outside the media sort of centre where we all were. And they love those flags. They don't have a problem with those flags. You can take a Union flag and suddenly you're a fascist or a bigot or some kind of racist. It's mad.
Yeah.
Totally bonkers.
It is. We should have had little flags today. Let's get them next week. Let's fly some little flags while we're talking.
Well, do you know, I have got some because
we did
them, I think, for Brexit. We actually flew little flags. I've got some still in my house. I'll bring them.
Let's get some. You'll upset the snowflakes, but I have a feeling you won't mind.
I don't think I'll mind that at all. Speaking of snowflakes, what about HSBC and the suspension of a banker who had the temerity to suggest that the climate change nutters were in fact nutters and maybe there was not such a financial sort of bill to pay because of climate change. And he's now been removed from his job. Extraordinary.
Well, he's suspended pending investigation. So this is Stuart Kirk. He's a global head of risk or asset management or something senior and highfalutin HSBC. And he prepared a talk on climate change and the impact on investments, which was approved by all of the management. So everybody saw it. But still, when he gave it, there were complaints about him. He's been suspended and being investigated. You know, funnily enough, all these stories today, Mike, and so much of what's going on in society, they all have a common thread that runs through them. You know, climate, transgender ideology, critical race theory, a little bit different to the flag, but there's, you know, there's some crossover there.
Same kind of idea.
Yep. They're all kind of quasi-religious. Mm. They all demand that you accept the dogma fully, that there is no deviation, that heretics are punished. I feel that there's a stage of society we're at now where we're living in a kind of a post-religious vacuum.
Yeah.
And people are grasping for values, but they're grasping for them in the most nasty and intolerant way. So it seems that a plurality of views at HSBC on climate are not to be accepted. Now, to be fair, he didn't deny the IPCC reports. He said there was a risk he would be labelled as a heretic by the nutjobs. He acknowledged that,
which
for instance,
is indeed what he has been labelled.
He has been. He acknowledged, for instance, that in the future there could be more fires. But what he said was also, as economies become richer, as societies become richer, you are able to use financing to adapt to those risks of climate change to mitigate them. There is nothing wrong with saying that. That's a good thing. We were talking about this just last week, that in fact the BBC got their claims wrong about deaths increasing from climate change, whereas in fact deaths are going down as societies we become better at managing floods, fires, tsunamis, storms and the rest of it. So I think he's right that fires are going to increase, but the sort of fires that are really increasing, the fires where people stock up the pyres and burn the witches, burn the heretics.
Yes.
And there he is.
But he's a lot of reasons for some of the fires, certainly in Australia and in California, are actually down to manoeuvring by local councils stroke governments to change the way that the land is actually managed, because in order to protect the climate, they have done things which weren't previously done, which would provide sort of natural fire breaks and that kind of thing. So a lot of the bushfires that happen in Australia are now happening because they're not doing a particular thing that they used to do, because it's dangerous for the climate. So actually it's counterproductive, and that is not what people want to hear.
Yeah, I know the fires are really multifactorial, but you're right, people don't want to hear it. And on a similar vein, one of the points that Stuart Kirk made was that in the banks, not just HSBC, you know, the wonks in the back room are having to twist the modelling to make it say what the climate activists want it to say. In essence, they're kind of having to bend the truth to make the fact match the, I won't say fiction, ideology.
It's the narrative, shall we say, that they have all sucked in and believed without really a shred of evidence, and that's what amazes me. The other one I loved this week was the complete hypocrisy being created by KPMG, who say, basically, in order not to be avoiding inclusivity, you mustn't talk about your skiing holiday, and you mustn't talk about the fact that you went to private school, and you mustn't talk about the fact that you might have had quite a privileged upbringing, because it might upset people who didn't. And you go, so you're not actually telling people not to go skiing, you're telling people to lie about where you went on holiday in order to protect somebody who hasn't said that they're bothered by it.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. So I don't go on skiing holidays and didn't go to private school. I'm jolly well glad for people that can afford villas with butlers in the Maldives, wherever. Great, go for it. That's nice. And no one should have to lie about it in front of other people. People have to toughen up a little bit.
I mean, really?
Again, there's a similar theme there between KPMG and HSBC. You know, you can tell people not to invest in fossil fuels and, you know, the sin list. That doesn't mean they're not going to, and they're not going to use oil.
Right.
You know, you can shame them about it. But in fact, you'll find that those stocks are doing really well at the moment. You can't change the dependence on oil overnight.
No. And you're never going to change the dependence on oil, because oil, I'm afraid, until they find an alternative which is as efficient, is the most efficient way of doing everything, of fueling cars, of setting planes up in the air, of, you know, heating your house, everything which is fossil fuel based is incredibly efficient as a resource, and there is nothing else that fulfills that, I'm afraid. And no matter, and I was saying this earlier in the week, no matter how good we think we are becoming and how close to net zero we get, we will have zero effect on the climate, because we're so small. In India, people are buying air conditioning machines and cars because they can. Now they've suddenly got the money, and there's a much more burgeoning and enlarged middle class, which didn't exist before. So the size of India and the numbers of people there can absolutely dwarf anything that we would do.
You're absolutely right, of course. I hope that pending this investigation, HSBC will stand by their man.
Yeah.
You know, we have to have plurality of opinion. We have to have debate. We get into a very dangerous place where you have to accede to dogma, and if you don't, you're out.
I've thought of a great new analogy. It's like holding a cup to the Niagara Falls and collecting some water from it as the falls continue to fall.
It is a bit like that. And China and India are the Niagara Falls in this equation.
Yeah, yeah. And we're going over it in a barrel, pretending that we're dry.
And the ESG running around with little cups trying to catch water. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
I love it. Very good. Well, Laura, thank you very much indeed. Laura will be back, of course, next Tuesday with more revelations and various fascinating facts for us. And coming up, we're going to be talking to Jamie Jenkins because he's going to give us the truth about monkeypox. We managed not to talk about that as well.
Oh, I deliberately didn't want to talk about monkeypox, Mike.
Fear-mongering nonsense, you know. I'm going to have a monkeypox party, I think, because I think that's the only way to go. Maybe I can combine it with the Jubilee party. Monkeypox and Jubilee together. What do you think?
I think that would be an outrageous slur again upon the flag. No, yes. No monkeypox near the flag.
No, monkeypox free zone. And it's also a Partygate free zone. This is a place to be for proper democracy and proper free speech. We are, of course, here all the way through until 1 o'clock when it's time for Ian Collins. We'll be back after this.
Talk Radio.
Reach for the story. Radio with grown-up opinions.
Don't get angry. Get on Talk Radio.
The home of common sense.
On your mobile, on your wavelength, Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here at Talk TV. We are the place to get the whole truth and nothing but the truth, because the man who tells us like it is, independent statistician, our favourite statistician indeed, Mr. Jamie Jenkins down in Wales. Jamie, very good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Mike. Before we go into the kind of the main stuff, I think Andon Deck have won the TV award the last 20 years. I think you and Kev now with a new Saturday Night Show might be in the running to.
Well,
listen,
how fun would that be? I've never won an award. I've never expected to be ever given one, and I'm pretty much prepared never to ever get one in my life. But you never know. We don't exactly tick all the boxes for them, do we? But my first question to you is how are you managing to avoid getting the monkeypox?
Yeah, so I think the story that we won't talk about that's on the front pages today, Mike, is probably keeping the monkeypox story off the front pages. And because you could really come up with some big headlines at the moment, because we've gone from a very small number of cases of monkeypox in the UK. It's gone up to about, I think, 57 now. So you could say it's gone up like 300 or 400% in the last week.
Well, I mean, I can't believe the numbers of news outlets that are getting so worked up about it and asking those ridiculous questions like they used to ask back in the day about COVID. How worried should we be about monkeypox? Answer, not very.
No, I think so. I was looking actually, Mike, so if you look in Africa, that's where monkeypox generally is. Well, it's an endemic disease there. Yeah. So it's kind of always in the country. And Congo is where you've got the vast majority of the cases of monkeypox in the world. And I looked at the stats there this morning, Michael, I knew I was coming on with you, and they've had about 1,200 odd cases of monkeypox in the first 4 months of this year. But if you compare that to this time last year, it's pretty similar. It's actually slightly lower. So it's not a case that monkeypox is kind of growing and spreading in Africa and that's spilling over to the rest of the world. That would be more of a concern, obviously, if you're seeing exponential growth in Africa, but we're not. So I think what we're seeing is kind of what people have been talking across the different media, Mike. We have seen these cases. Remember, now we're looking for them as well. That's one of the reasons why you find more cases.
Well, that's it. I mean, I'm pretty sure that over the course of my lifetime, we've had all sorts of outbreaks of things like avian flu or, you know, some other form of flu that comes in every winter, slightly different species of flu. We've had outbreaks of cholera that have happened in different countries and sometimes have spread because people have flown places. I remember a woman flying into Heathrow a few years ago from, I think, New Delhi, who had the plague, you know. But people don't, you know, you don't go running around shutting everything down, going, oh, my God, we're all going to get the plague. Well, because you're not.
No, of course not, Mike. And even Ebola is still kind of going transmitted.
Yeah, I mean, I don't fancy Ebola much, but I mean, I don't think I've got much chance of getting it, to be honest.
No, and with the monkeypox virus, Mike, actually, it's totally different to COVID. Even the health experts have been going on the BBC saying it's pretty, you know, the risk is pretty low. It is much, much difficult to spread compared to COVID. Mm. You kind of need that very close person-to-person contact, whether or not you're kind of using, touching clothing or touching the blisters. I suppose there's one difference, which is quite clear for us in terms of this, is you pretty much know you would have got it because you get all these blisters on you rather than COVID, where you're sometimes not sure if you've got COVID unless you've got a test.
Oh, I think loads of people have had COVID without really knowing. I mean, we were laughing earlier on in the week about Nicola Sturgeon, not because she has COVID, because that would be cruel, but because she actually tested herself and discovered that she had it. And everyone's going, who does that anymore? I mean, even the schools have stopped doing that.
But yeah, and you can't even get normal tests these days, Mike, and the travel restrictions that have just been eased a little bit in Spain. Some countries, Mike, are still asking you to prove if you haven't had a vaccine in the last 270 days. I had two.
Yeah.
My last one was back end of last summer, so I can't visit a lot of countries.
Well, this is it. Most people now who took the vaccine in order to travel or to go and see family or something like that are now considered to be the same as people who are unvaccinated.
No, and you can show this proof of recovery if you've had COVID in the last 6 months, Mike, but most of the people haven't bothered testing.
Yeah, but if you haven't got that, you're screwed, aren't you?
No, indeed, Mike. But so, yeah, monkeypox, I would say, don't panic. The more worrying, I think, Mike, still this cost of living crisis is. So I put a tweet out this morning. Record figures now we've got. The petrol prices at a record high. It's never been so high in the country.
Yeah.
Now, it's 168 on average for unleaded, 181 for diesel. Some people are tweeting me back and say, I wish I could get those prices because wherever they are, they're much, much higher.
Yeah.
That's the average. So
well, I'll tell you, the last two times I've filled up my car, the most recent one was this weekend, I'm paying over 180 something for diesel.
Yeah, and where you are, Mike, you know, it's probably more expensive down there in the south of the country as well. And that's about an extra 350 quid a year extra that people are paying at the pumps compared to a year ago.
Mm.
But the Chancellor, Mike, because petrol price is about 40 pence higher than this time last year, he's raking in nearly 3.8 billion extra just in the VAT alone.
So, it's amazing.
You know, these windfall tax on the energy companies, he's going to put a windfall tax on the Chancellor as well.
Well, you should. I mean, I've always said the windfall tax is a bad idea because what that will end up doing is continuing to sort of encourage the sellers of the petrol to continue to charge a massive amount of money for it. Whereas if you actually said to them, no, we're going to tax you unless you put the prices down, then they probably would put the prices down, which then makes it easier for us.
Indeed, Mike, it'll bring inflation down. I was talking last week and tweeting about it, the fact that if you got rid of the green levy, if you started cutting VAT, because what is inflation, Mike? It just takes a basket of goods, looks at the average change in price year on year, and if we start cutting some of these taxes, you know, that the consumer are paying, that will bring kind of inflation down and start bringing that a little bit more under control. But the governor of the Bank of England doesn't seem to be able to kind of understand all these different things, or the Treasury. They just seem to be in cloud cuckoo land, I think, Mike.
Well, that's the trouble. And I mean, during the whole COVID experience, and that's what I'm calling it from now on, you and I used to talk regularly because you'd look at the various health statistics coming out during the course of any given week. Is that still going on, and are we still paying attention, or has that all kind of stopped now?
Well, we don't really pay much attention to the daily figures now, Mike, because people, as you know, aren't going forward for tests. And because people have, Omicron is so much more transmissible, people still quote on Twitter, Mike, how many deaths have occurred within 28 days of a positive COVID test, right, which those figures kind of become unfit for purpose about 6-7 months ago. But we do get the ONS figures every week on deaths linked to COVID. They're falling, Mike. The most recent figures came out this morning, and about 96% of the deaths that occurred in the most recent week were not related to COVID at all. You know, so when you start looking at the figures, COVID infection rates have been coming down as well. So we eased all the restrictions, started going into that living with COVID plan. And since doing that, infections have started coming down. Mike, I'll probably be on with you in September, October, because The Guardian will write a story that infections are starting to go up because obviously it's a respiratory virus. Luckily, we're in that living with COVID phase. Things aren't as dramatic as what they were, and deaths are no much different to the time of year of what you'd expect anyway.
Well, nobody's talking about it anymore, really, are they? I mean, I don't hear anyone conversing about COVID. Occasionally, you hear about somebody who has it, like Nicola Sturgeon or like Jonathan Van Tam, who apparently wasn't able to go and collect his knighthood from Buckingham Palace last week because he had COVID. But I mean, you know, those days where somebody would say, oh, yeah, so-and-so's off, they got COVID. I mean, it's just not happening.
It's not happening, Mike, but I can guarantee I'll be speaking to you come October, September time, October, November, when we go into the winter, because I have not seen any plan from the NHS as to how they're going to cope this winter. Because we know the NHS always say NHS is overrun every winter. We know that. I've seen no plan that if infections start going up and patients start going into hospital with COVID, not specifically because of it, what are they going to do? And it's going to get the usual scare tactics, Mike. They're going to say hospitals are overrun with patients who are coming in, having tested positive for COVID during this respiratory virus season. And they haven't seen a single bit of a plan from the government in terms of what they're going to do to ensure that doesn't happen. That's what's going to happen, Mike. And come the winter time, me and you will be talking about the fact that all the scaremongers are coming back out. That's my prediction.
Yes, I wouldn't be at all surprised because, again, you know, we could go back 10, 20 years to every single story that appeared in one way, shape or form, either a Daily Mirror or indeed the Guardian, as you say, or the Observer, in which they would say that the NHS is facing another winter crisis. You know, literally nothing has been done to make the NHS better. In fact, if anything, the NHS is now in worse shape than it was even this time last year, because we're being told that more and more people are working from home. Fewer and fewer people are actually still at the sharp end of the hospitals. A lot of the hospitals empty because they haven't got anybody to bring in, because they don't like bringing people in, people waiting outside in ambulances. I mean, the whole thing's a shambles.
No, I saw a story yesterday, Mike, as well, somebody recommending that consultants work from home.
Yes, right.
And get the clerical staff to do all the cancer scans.
Yeah,
and then
great.
You just look at the image. Basically, where if they're going to do that, you may as well outsource people who are going to look at the images to India or kind of Australia or wherever all the doctors are in terms of these days.
Well, I mean, you're now basically told to look after yourself. We had a guy called in yesterday. He said he wanted to get a repeat prescription. The people at the doctor's surgery said, that's fine, but before we send you that, how about you do yourself a blood pressure test? And he's like, well, I haven't got a blood pressure machine. You know, they're not even doing that anymore.
Now, Mike, your show has become the official opposition to the government on the NHS over the last few years.
Yeah.
You know, Labour are talking about things we won't talk about this morning, but it's just bonkers that the Labour aren't really capitalising on some of this. I suppose part of the problem, though, Mike, is I live in Wales, as you know, just as much of a problem over here. And who runs it? Welsh Labour. Mm. It doesn't seem to be whichever colour or every party takes over this NHS. It just seems to be the same problem. And I think one of the things, Mike, you've been bang on over the last couple of years is that no other country in the world adopts what we do in the UK.
No.
So, you know, if nobody's copying what we do, surely that's a kind of a highlighting there that you wouldn't do what you would currently doing in the UK if you were starting again from scratch, would you?
No, you absolutely wouldn't. And how is Mr. Drakeford these days? What's he up to?
So last week, Mike, he flew over to Oslo and
he
was over there. Nice. Talking to the Norwegians about climate change. And obviously, he would have flown over there. The Welsh government don't do international relations as a policy thing. We've got the cost of living crisis in this country, and you've got Mark Drakeford flying off to Oslo. We haven't heard much about him over the last few months, Mike, in part because, as I say, COVID's dying off in terms of the daily media narrative and things. And all the talk is obviously about all the things that are going on in Downing Street and Keir Starmer up in Durham and things. So there's very little talk about Mark Drakeford at the moment, but no doubt he'll pull another rabbit out of the hat soon.
Well, listen, you've just helped me out because I was wondering who I was going to put on my Plank of the Week list, which we're filming this afternoon with Kevin O'Sullivan. We'll have to get you in for that, by the way, if you're ever up in town. We might like to have you on Plank of the Week, but I think we could nominate Mr. Drakeford for his little trip to Oslo to save the climate. What a brilliant idea.
Or Plank of the Year, Mike. You know, Mark Drakeford, Nicola Sturgeon, regular people in there. And
well, listen, we've got
Jamie Oliver in as well with his Eton mess.
Yes, we've got a running total, and Drakeford's definitely in the top 20. So we'll keep putting you up there. Be great stuff. Jamie, good to talk to you again. Thanks very much indeed. Jamie Jenkins there, our favourite independent statistician, running a rule across monkeypox. Is it dangerous? Not very. And what about Mark Drakeford? Imagine flying off to Oslo to talk about climate change with the Norwegians. Why don't you just go on Zoom, for heaven's sake? These people make you laugh, don't they? Coming up in the next hour, Ian Williams is going to join us, former foreign correspondent for NBC and Channel 4, author of Every Breath You Take About China's New Tyranny. He's just been to Taiwan, and so he's going to tell us what he found when he got there and what it's like coming back from there. Also, I'm going to tell you a story about some rather odd shoes that some weird people wear. Some of them, not a million miles from here, it has to be said. 0344 499 1000 is the number. This is, of course, Talk TV.
Fast Talk.
Street Talk.
Mike Graham.
Fighting the good fight with all his might. Providing a welcome dose of common sense for the common people.
Solid Talk.
Hot Talk.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
See it, hear it, think it. Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV with you all the way through until 1 o'clock, of course. Prime Minister's questions coming up tomorrow. We may have to cover Partygate because it'll be interesting to see how Keir Starmer deals with it, actually, because he's still on the run from Durham. Nobody really knows quite what he's going to do if, in fact, the police find that he broke the rules. But some people are getting very worked up. You won't be hearing about it from here on my show anyway. You might hear it on Ian Collins' show, but certainly not here. So don't bother ringing in to try and get me to talk about it. It ain't happening. There's lots of other things to talk about. The RMT are probably going to go on strike, and you won't be able to get on a train that goes anywhere that you want to go. Also, of course, we'll be talking about the Jubilee, the plans for which are still in the making, but looks like you will be told by your local council, as we mentioned yesterday, don't put any bunting up, don't drink anything out of glass because you might drop it, and you might, of course, trip over. So be very careful moving around. I mean, for heaven's sake. Ian Williams is here, though, however, former foreign correspondent, of course, of Channel 4 News. He's been to Taiwan. He was in a few weeks ago telling us about his experiences with China, his new book. He's been to Taiwan to tell us about what's happening there and how they're dealing with the post-COVID economy, plus everything else that's been going on, not least Joe Biden, who said just the other day that he might actually consider operating in some kind of militaristic way if China went into Taiwan. Let's have a look. Or perhaps let's not.
You didn't want to get involved in the Ukraine conflict militarily for obvious reasons. Are you willing to get involved militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that?
Yes.
You are?
That's a commitment we made.
Yes, that's a commitment we made, said President Joe Biden in Tokyo. Ian Williams is here. Ian, very good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Mike. Good to be back.
Thank you very much indeed. Now, what do you make of that statement from Biden? It's slightly worrying if you're concerned about military activity around anywhere near China.
Yeah, but he said it two or three times before. And each time he said that, he seemed to row back on it, or right. at least the people around him did. And say that policy hasn't changed.
Right.
I mean, policy is one of what they've always called strategic ambiguity,
right.
i.e. they wouldn't let China really know what they'd do in the event of hostilities to keep them slightly wrong-footed.
Yeah.
But there's been a fierce debate in the States about whether they should move towards a more forthright underwriting of Taiwanese defence.
Right.
A lot has changed. Taiwan's important to the world economy. It's a liberal democracy. It's under threat like never before. And slowly the Americans have been shifting their position towards one that would suggest they would support Taiwan in the event of an invasion or other hostilities. But as I say, you have to be a bit cautious because Joe said this two or three times, but then they've rowed back on it and insisted that it doesn't add up to a change
of
policy.
And what's the position at the moment? Do the Americans supply anything to Taiwan in terms of defence or anything like
they
that?
They do under what they call a law that was introduced some years ago. They have to supply defence equipment or equipment sufficient for Taiwan to defend itself,
right.
which is a very broad definition.
Ambiguous, yeah.
And it's interpreted in different ways by different members of the different presidents down
yes.
the line. But from my experience in talking to people in Taiwan, they're not holding their breath over. I mean, yes, it would be nice to have Japanese and American support, but they're looking to try and rely on themselves to build up their own defence capacity. And they're really watching Ukraine incredibly closely.
Yes, I was going to say that because people have drawn the conclusion, haven't they, that if Putin was to be victorious in Ukraine, we're not even really sure what that means. You know, would that encourage China to think, well, we could go into Taiwan, nobody's really going to do anything?
Yeah, that is, they are watching. I think China's watching very closely. I think they've been shocked by the extent and the strength of Western sanctions and the unity, which they don't think will last
right.
and they're hoping won't last, and they're trying to learn. And I think they're pretty shocked by Russian incompetence because, you know, they signed this big deal ahead of the Olympic Games, this the sense that there were no limits to their partnership,
right.
that they were going to build a new world order together. So Russian incompetence has come as a bit of a shock. But
yeah.
in Taiwan, it's been something which is quite encouraging. And they've looked at what's been going on over there. They've looked at the Ukrainian resilience, the will to fight, the fact that they can push back an overwhelmingly superior military.
Yeah.
And they've said, hey, you know, we want a bit of that. And they already have a doctrine called, well, it's been nicknamed the porcupine strategy.
Right.
The idea being you make the island indigestible
yes.
by all sorts of asymmetric
means. So it's
a
very bad idea to go in other words.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You can't match China plane for plane, ship for ship,
right.
but you can acquire some pretty nasty kit from smart mines to drones to tiny boats that
yeah.
could hide easily with pretty nasty missiles on them to take out Chinese shipping, and you make the cost of any invasion extraordinarily high and make them thick twice. And that's the route they're going down.
Okay. And you were there as recently as last week. What's the atmosphere there? Is it different from any time you've been before? Does it seem more kind of defensive?
It does, because before you always had what they used to call grey zone warfare. You always had a lot of cyber attacks, a lot of disinformation, a lot of intimidation. China routinely sending in aircraft or ships to intimidate the island, getting close, then turning back. But it was always kind of background noise.
Yes.
You had the sense that, you know, the Taiwanese got used to it.
Yeah.
But now I think the war in Ukraine has been a real wake-up call for them, because there's a lot in common between Putin and Xi.
Mm.
They both have these visions of recreating their old empires.
Yes.
They both aggrieved. There's a lot in common with the
and
way they look at the world.
There's very much a sort of personality cult going on as well, isn't there?
Both of them. Yeah, they're both very powerful figures. They have eliminated pretty much any opposition. Not that there was a lot anyway. And there's been, in the case of Xi, a cult of personality of the type that we haven't seen since Mao.
Right.
And, you know, and the recovery, as they would call it, of Taiwan. And, of course, the whole argument about Taiwan being part of China is extraordinarily spurious.
Mm.
But the recovery of Taiwan, as they call it, has been part of his big vision of, you know, the rejuvenation of a great Chinese nation.
And does he give the impression that the Chinese people would want to see that? Because, obviously, Vladimir Putin gives the impression that the Russian people would like to see the return of Ukraine and maybe Lithuania and maybe a lot of other countries that have sort of been lost.
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of China, of what goes on in China, it's very hard to decipher what people really think.
Mm.
But because communism in any meaningful form doesn't really exist in China, I mean, the Communist Party is now a nationalist party.
Right.
It's rabidly nationalist.
Pretty much the only party, presumably.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are no other parties, but it is rabidly nationalist. And in the absence of anything meaningful that can be called communism in China, banging the ethnic drum and this whole notion of sort of ethnic nationalism, chauvinism, is all they've got to fall back on. So I guess there is a fair degree of support because that kind of stuff resonates.
Yes, of course it does. And you were saying that Xi himself is the subject of a few rumours about his health, and as Putin is indeed, and we're always speculating as to whether he's got something wrong with him.
He is. The rumour mill has been absolute overdrive.
Yeah.
You know, Xi is terminally ill. Xi's about to be ousted by his premier.
Mm.
Xi's economic policies are being rolled back. Xi won't get an extension on his term later this year.
Right.
I mean, the Communist Party is an impenetrable black box,
yes.
Even more opaque under Xi. We don't know, but it's a lot of fun reading this stuff.
Yeah.
And it's all emerging through overseas Chinese websites,
right.
Of bloggers, YouTubers. And this is an established means by where disgruntled officials in Beijing leak this stuff out. To friendly overseas outlets. They amplify it. Then it comes back into China and gets re-churned. So, you know, China watchers are having a field day. And, of course, China watching is a very big exercise, largely because most of them haven't got a clue.
Mm.
So you can pretty much read what you want into it.
We had an extraordinary story yesterday. Robert Clark came in from Civitas to tell us the story of the NHS connection and how £600 million of our money is going into China every single month to buy all sorts of stuff that we really couldn't, we don't have to buy from China.
Now, it's chilling, the amount of dependency that we're allowing in critical areas or strategic areas. I mean, if there's one lesson, overwhelming lesson to me from what's going on in Ukraine and Russia, you know, there's this big shock about how dependent we were, or certain countries were, on gas and oil.
Yeah.
And you think, well, hello, you know, it's not a good idea to be dependent on any tyrant, whether that tyrant is sitting in Moscow or Beijing.
Or maybe Saudi Arabia.
I mean, you know, I'm not saying we should stop trading with these countries, but you've got to look at your degree of dependency,
absolutely,
especially in critical areas.
Well, the Germans are screwed, really, because they can't stop the pipeline traffic. They can't just suddenly go, right, that's it, we're not going to take any more gas from you, because they need it.
Yeah, and they went through this whole thing that we can improve these countries by trading with them and being friendly with them and ultimately intertwining our economies, and sort of look where that got them. And yeah, the degree of dependence on China is even greater. Mm. And yeah, this should really be a wake-up call to examine those Chinese dependencies as critically as we now are with those in Russia.
And how easy was it to get into Taiwan? Because certainly I speak for myself, I may speak for a lot of other people, I know literally nothing about how easy it is to get there, to get in there, what you need to do to go.
Usually it's pretty easy. I mean, Taiwan's an open, pretty, you know, it's a liberal democracy, it's open, it's thriving, it's a very, very accessible place. It's everything that China isn't. But they've had a zero COVID policy of their own. The borders have been closed for 2 years. They're now reopening. They're looking at the horror show across the strait in Shanghai and thinking, oh, we're not going to go down there. We're going to learn to live with Omicron.
Right.
But I still had to do 10 days in quarantine in my little hotel room, you know, my jogging track around the bed, my elastic exercise bands.
Quarantine in a place like that is proper quarantine, I'm assuming, yeah?
Yeah, but it's pretty efficient.
Because you're not allowed out for a fag, as it were.
No. And, you know, it's 10 days of this, but they deliver the food to your door, and it's, you know, it's good food. It's Taiwan. Everything's quite efficient. But was I pleased to get out of there.
Yeah, I bet. And then you spent your time, we've only really got a minute left, bizarrely. Yeah. I don't know where the time's gone, but you spent your time just talking to people, collecting info.
I did. I mean, I hoped to get to the close islands to China, but the weather was foul over the weekend. I was going to do that. You couldn't rely on the planes coming back. So I was mainly in and around Taipei, talking to officials. I spoke to the foreign minister, the digital minister, the guy who was really much the father of the porcupine strategy, in who feels very vindicated now in terms of the new sort of defensive strategies they're pushing through. And to the vast majority of people I spoke to, Ukraine geographically is a very long way away, but in every other sense, it's chillingly close.
Yes, I suppose so. Well, fascinating stuff. I mean, I know you've got a new book. You've very kindly brought the Every Breath You Take book, which is this one, China's New Tyranny. I'll hold it up so you can get it. And you're working on another one, so we'll see you soon, I guess.
Yep, out in August.
Brilliant stuff. Ian Williams there, former Channel 4, now author, of course, expert on what goes on in China and now indeed in Taiwan as well. Coming up, we've got much more to do. We're going to be taking calls from you as well, of course, 03444991000. We've got Dr. Rachel Ward coming up as well, who's going to tell us about a Rebuild the GP campaign, because so many people now are suffering because they can't see a GP. So many GPs are quitting because they say they can't make enough money. The whole NHS sort of edifice appears to be crumbling before our very eyes. Ian and I were just talking about the sort of the state of things, government departments that don't work, governments that aren't working terribly well, and of course the NHS itself, which is in dire need of some kind of reform. We'll take calls on that, of course, as well. 0344 499 1000 is the number. This is Talk TV.
Talk Radio. Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday, on Talk Radio via DAB, online, or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.